Right, what's going on over here then? Looks like it's time for another OneLiner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig, and with me, as always, Scott Morris.
Well, hello there.
And the man who those in the know as Drew.
Greetings.
Brackets, Tavendale. Now, we have a varied podcast for you today. We will be discussing Les Miserables, Zero Dark Thirty, Gangster Squad, and Django Unchained. So without further ado, let me waste little time and crack on.
I didn't know your middle name was Brackets, Drew.
Yeah, it's one of, I never use it. It's just one of those things you have to put down in official documents, you know.
It's his mob name. Okay, got Jimmy Two Times, we got Frankie Knives. Over here in the corner, we got Drew Brackets. Hey, why do they call you Drew Brackets? Why the fuck do you think they call me Brackets, you dumb fuck? Hey, all right, forget about it, huh? Go talk to the guy. So let's kick off then with a discussion about Les Miserables. Adapted from the highly successful West End musical, itself derived from a less successful run in Parisian theatres. Hugh Jackman plays the iconic role of convict Jean Valjean, who, upon parole, decides to prove himself the best dad in the history of the world as, against the backdrop of the French Revolution, he commits his life to selflessly raising his adoptive daughter, while all the time evading the long arm of the law in the form of Russell Crowe's dogged... He's a detective inspector. Yes, Russell Crowe's dogged detective inspector, Javert. Now, Scott, Tom Hooper won wide acclaim for his previous film, which was the Oscar-winning The King's Speech. However, Les Miserables, it's fair to say, has divided audiences, not entirely, but probably slightly more, is it fair to say?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm quite happy knowing that I'm in very much the minority opinion about this. Everyone seems to love Les Miserables, think of it, its UK name. It just didn't grab me the way that apparently has latched upon to you. I've no great overarching thing about, you know, why it's, you know, wrong thematically or systematically or any of these pieces going on about the cinematography being not up to par and things like that. I don't agree with any of that. I just didn't like most of the singing in it, and that's a problem in a musical. I'm not the best person to tell you about this because I knew going in that I don't like any of the songs in Les Miserables, and I wasn't particularly taken with what I'd seen from the performances that I knew would be in there. I suppose it's to its credit that it did win me over somewhat by the second half of the film, when it gets onto the sections that are really more staffed with singers that can act rather than actors that can sing. I think that did work better. However, the first half was enough of a downer that I just couldn't really be bothered investing much emotion in it by that point. I don't like the way Russell Crowe sings all that much, and I really didn't like the way Hugh Jackman sings, which is not to say that either of them can't carry a tune or anything like that. I just don't like their tone. I don't like the way that Hugh Jackman has to end every note in like this sustained vibrato. It does make it sound like
didn't you like the fact that Hugh Jackman only stole a loaf of bread?
Well, he stole a loaf of bread. It does make it sound like he's about to start doing a Jimmy Savile impersonation on every single note. It just put me off my stride a bit, and I didn't like it that much. And that's really my only issue with it. There's a lot of other performances in there that are quite good. As you mentioned, Anne Hathaway does steal the show, and how the younger characters, whose names escape me at the moment, but they tend to work much better. There's a lot of visionary scope there. Certainly the introductory scenes are pretty breathtaking. There's a lot there that I can see why people would like it. I just didn't. And to be fair, I knew that I wouldn't like it going into it, and didn't really do anything to change my mind about it. So that's really my only point with it, is that if you are not a massive fan of musicals in general, and you already know you're not particularly down with what Les Miserables will give to you, then it's not going to change your mind. Bonus points, of course, for it being set in Paris and having everyone going around talking Cockney, leading to the wonderful scenes of people going, Vive la France, da-di-da-di-da. Yeah, well done.
And at one point, I'm sure the little sort of street urchin kid, I can't remember his name, who I'm sure at some point pretty much shouts governor.
Yes.
Baffling, absolutely baffling. I have to disagree with you on several points, but only from a personal view, obviously. I'm not going to disagree with your interpretation or your reaction to the film, because that is entirely your own. But I too went into Les Miserables like no fan of musicals. By and large, they wind me up, and the of those I've seen recently, if you offered me the opportunity to watch again sort of Moulin Rouge or Mamma Mia, or take a .45 caliber bullet to the mouth I would opt for the gun without any kind of resistance whatsoever. But there was something about the notion of Les Mis, about which I knew nothing plot-wise, actually. I'm very ignorant of such things. I'm not a regular theatre attendee. That sort of intrigued me about it. And I think probably what it was that the obvious investment that Tom Hooper had made and the boldness with which everyone I knew who had seen the film was telling me that he had approached it. And I think it's fair to say that he's made the decision to go all in, and that works for a great deal of the film based on the strength of the cast. However, in going all in, which I think was the right decision, he has also made the decision to have the actors sing every line of dialogue, and I mean literally every line. The only words which aren't sung are occasional words here and there. I think you're lucky if there are 10 words in the whole film which aren't delivered tunefully. And that's a bold decision, and it might have, you know, and by and large I think it pays off. However, it is the most tiresome aspect of the film, and the one which I found the most difficult to get through. I found myself having to very much plough through that, because I think, what is it, just over 2.5 hours long? I think, someone correct me on that if I'm wrong.
Well, it was 15 or 16 hours.
Yeah, 15 or 16 hours. If you're going to do that in a film, then there's only so much time that you can reasonably ask the average audience to invest in that, because it does require some sort of degree of commitment on an audience's behalf. And for me, Les Mis really could have done with 20 minutes to half an hour being excised from the running time, which I think was some, maybe not with some judicious editing, unless you were to remove almost all the sections involving Sacha Baron Cohen and Helena Bonham Carter.
How much more of a better film would it be if you'd done that?
Yeah, exactly. You could almost have gotten away with doing away with those entirely plot-wise and saved yourself that sort of 20 minutes. But I think realistically you'd probably have to go back to the script and make your changes there. But I think you could reasonably expect to do this film in 2 hours, 2 hours 10, and it might not have worn quite so thin. Having said that, almost every other aspect of the film I thought was bold, adventurous, and the commitment of everyone involved. Most people I know who I've spoken to about the film don't realise that Hugh Jackman comes ostensibly from a musical background, and they were all quite surprised at his performance and his singing. Whether or not you buy into his particular style of delivery, you would have to assume that that is an aesthetic choice made between, you know, each member of the cast and Tom Hooper as to how he wants that to be delivered. But there's no denying that the performances in the film are frequently startling. And, like, I'm a big fan of Hugh Jackman anyway. I think he's both a great actor and seemingly quite an affable bloke. I find him a reassuring screen presence. However, I've never seen him offer as much commitment to a role as I have in this. And the sort of opening 10, 15 minutes of this film, where you have just long single shots of Hugh Jackman delivering his lines to the camera with startling emotional investment, kind of had me fucking knocked back in my seat for the first 15-20 minutes. And I immediately thought, this is, one way or another, however this turns out, this is going to be really interesting. And by the time you get to Anne Hathaway's rendition of I Dreamed a Dream, like, again, I've said it before, I think, and I'll say it again, I'm not the world's biggest Anne Hathaway fan. I mean, I, as well as she played the role of Catwoman in the most recent Batman film, I still wasn't enamoured with her, you know, as an actress per se. But anyone who comes away from this film having watched her writ large on the screen delivering I Dreamed a Dream without at least acknowledging that she gave one of the most powerful performances of the year in that sort of 5 minutes, I would find it hard to accept her opinion on such a thing with any kind of credibility. Again, I'm no fan of musicals. I wasn't even a huge fan of the King's Speech, but I think in terms of boldness directorially, Les Mis speaks more of Tom Hooper than I think that film did. Stylistically, two massively different films. It'd be interesting to see what he does next. I don't know if his next project has been announced, has it?
Not a clue.
Not a clue. We have no clue. I have no clue. For all its flaws, there's no fault in really the ambition of Les Mis, and I think largely by sheer force of those performances of almost universally the entire cast. I think you're right, probably, Scott, in that the sort of second half of the film, where the film relies more on, I believe, members of the cast of the actual stage musical. I want to say the girl who played Eponine, whose name escapes me now, is actually a member of the London cast. And that section of the film, as a film, I think the second half probably moves along more interestingly, whereas the first half is concerned with these sort of big, bold, individual performances, which Hathaway and Jackman, at least, I think, are almost impeccable in. I think I pointed out in my review that perhaps Jackman loses a bit of momentum through the middle section of the film. Russell Crowe, I know everybody's had a lot to say about Russell Crowe. I will give Russell Crowe a pass on this. Under normal circumstances, I might not, but I think people are overlooking the nature of the character of Javert. I can't back that up with paperwork because, again, this is the first experience I've had of Les Mis, but my interpretation of the character was that he is a bit of a dogged, cold fish. He is emotionally, not bankrupt, I don't think it's fair to say, but being the kind of person who emotionally would cut his nose off despite his face, and I think considers himself...
He keeps his powder dry.
I think Russell Crowe delivers a suitable performance for that. Probably not as strong within the context of that character as the other members of the cast, but still better than I can imagine a lot of other people delivering the role. I think he's been given quite short thrift by a lot of the press over that performance. But yes, I'm going to give Russell Crowe a pass on this. Overall, I just kind of feel... Obviously, there are flaws with the film and it has difficulty sustaining its momentum, but overall, I just think I was really surprised to find myself leaving the cinema having thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think it succeeds almost in spite of itself.
I think it doesn't. I think it doesn't succeed because of itself.
Pistols at dawn.
As I say, I there's plenty of things that I can imagine people would go to see and like in this film, and certainly a lot of people have liked it. I don't really think there are too many people that have a dissenting opinion on the general thing that this is pretty damn good. I just don't like the way that half the cast sing in it, which is a problem. So it might as well be playing like industrial techno at me, just not going to appreciate it. And that might actually be a more interesting adaptation. I had kind of forgotten until you brought it up. Sacha Baron Cohen is teeth grindingly irritating, and probably the single thing that made me just want to, you know, vomit my insides out. Him and Helena Bonham Carter, who's his partner in crime in the...
Yeah, they're those classical roles, the purpose of which I assume are to provide, you know, a bit of emotional levity amongst all the sort of tear-jerking gravitas of the rest of the performances.
Well, yes, but they're on screen for like 5 hours or something. Is it insufferable?
I know. And they're not particularly likeable characters. They are constantly, literally, as with every line they deliver, they are pickpocketing people and thieving here and thieving there and robbing people blind. And we're supposed to find them somehow amusing, whereas really they are worthless scum who I felt detracted from it. Like I say, man, there's your 20, 25 minutes of time that you could probably excise from the film, and I would have enjoyed it even more. I totally wouldn't take you to task on any of your opinion at all. Like I say, I mean, I come out sort of surprised at how much I enjoyed it, and like I say, I felt it succeeded in spite of itself. Put it this way, I can understand why other people wouldn't enjoy it. I know other people who didn't enjoy it as much either. I think what was interesting, or well, not interesting about it, what was startling about it was quite the reaction it got from the audience as a whole, and like especially during Anne Hathaway's performance. It's the first time I've ever been in a cinema where people are openly weeping. And sort of like every third person behind you is sort of like this sort of thing.
They're all farmers.
Yeah, definitely. It's no, seriously true. Honestly, it was remarkable the emotional response it got from people, and for better or worse, I think it's remarkable that a film can do that, full stop. And I can only imagine that that's exactly what Tom Hooper was going for, and in that sense he certainly nailed it. Not a perfect film, but overwhelmed almost by how much I enjoyed it in comparison to how much I expected to. And I think something like this, which is a musical which doesn't feel the need to be camp in the way that Romeo and Juliet... not Romeo and Juliet, sorry, because it wasn't a musical. Well, was Romeo and Juliet a musical? Baz Luhrmann's version?
Don't think so.
I can't remember.
I remember now, but I don't think
certainly,
so.
Certainly Moulin Rouge and Mamma Mia, it's almost as if they felt somewhat embarrassed to be musicals, and the only way to present a musical is to camp it up. Whereas this version of Les Mis certainly isn't camp, and I think represents musicals in general in a far better light than those previous successful entries. And given its box office success, it'll be interesting to see what the next musical adaptation of something is going to be, because undoubtedly now there will be one. So without further ado then, let us move on to Django Unchained, which I believe Drew is going to tell us a little about.
You'll remember that the disappointing Inglourious Basterds wasn't a war movie. A lot of people thought it was going to be. It was, in fact, a Jewish revenge fantasy. Django Unchained is likewise a revenge fantasy, though this time with black American slaves instead of Jews. What it is not, emphatically not, is a historical epic, a critique of mid-19th century American politics, an exploration of race relations, or anything remotely like that. Now, I had no idea at all what Django Unchained would be. I think I saw a trailer once, and that was about my entire preparation for viewing. I read nothing about it, saw nothing about it, so thought, this is a film, I'll go and watch it. But what I certainly didn't think it would be was any of the things I mentioned before. But, and this staggers me, there is apparently a sizable number of people who thought it would be, and are most upset that it is not, which frankly beggars belief. But as to what it actually is, it's the story of two unlikely partners, the titular Django, played by Jamie Foxx, and Christoph Waltz's King Schultz. Schultz, a former dentist in the fine traditions of Doc Holliday, is now a gunman and a bounty hunter who seeks out the enslaved Django as he believes he can help him identify three men he's seeking. After that business is concluded, Schultz, impressed by Django, suggests they team up for the winter to raise some cash before Django attempts to find the whereabouts of his wife, Brumhilda. And after shooting many, many people, winter finally ends, and the duo discover in their investigations that Brumhild is in the employ of one Calvin Candy at the misleadingly happy-sounding plantation Candyland. The two travel there to try and persuade Mr. Candy to part with Brumhilda, but the negotiations to buy her don't go well, to put it mildly.
Break down?
That would be one way to put it. Yes, they break down, and many people get shot many times. But here's the important thing about Django. It's a hoot. The villains are odious, their actions even more so. The heroes are preposterous, their actions even more so. Every round of ammunition is at least three parts TNT. More blood is released after a person is shot than could ever have actually been contained in their entire body. And, as you'd expect from a Tarantino film, the dialogue is something no human being would ever actually say. The violence, and there's certainly plenty of that, is cartoonish, but it's brilliant. It's silly. It's gory, it's ludicrous fun, and not one thing in the entire film should be taken seriously. Now, it's not flawless, and Scott suggested to me that it's had some awards talk, which fortunately I was never aware of. I tend to avoid such nonsense, so I didn't have any. I'm not angry that it's been considered for that, and it's never going to be considered a classic, but it's a lot of fun. Definitely worth a watch. Christoph Waltz in particular is just a joy to watch, but some of the verbal sparring between him and Leo DiCaprio is, again, it's nothing anybody would actually say, but it's just really, really entertaining. There we go. And certainly much more entertaining than Glorious Bastards was.
Ganz interessant, Scott.
I concur. I probably maybe enjoyed it a little bit more than Drew did. But it's just a hell of a lot of fun. There's some of Tarantino's best dialogue in there, which is not to say his most realistic dialogue, but it's some of his most sort of witty and entertaining dialogue. There's some really well-realised characters. The sort of the two double acts you've got going on of Christopher Waltz and Jamie Foxx, his sort of tutoring Django along his way to become a badass. And then you've got an equally interesting double act going on between Leonardo DiCaprio and Samuel L. Jackson. As his,
yeah, it's quite impressive for quite how unlikable Sam Jackson is in that film, yet it's still entertaining.
Yeah, and when these two worlds collide, then it's a hell of a lot of amusement factor going on there. Now, amusement is the main thing. It's not much in the way of drama or anything like that. It is far too ridiculous to be in any way tense or to be taken seriously as a drama, which is why I was puzzled to see it getting awards buzz for like Best Picture and things like that. It's a big stupid slice of fun, that's fine, but it's not the sort of thing you would typically expect to be heard of in the running for this kind of things, and it doesn't really say much of anything. There's no comment about antebellum USA or anything like this. It's simply a ridiculous excuse to shoot lots and lots of people, and with increasingly ridiculous effects work.
Yes.
You know, people getting shot with a six-shooter and then flying backwards like 20 foot. And it is a daft film. But that's why it's so much fun.
Yeah, there's plenty of like really unpleasant stuff in there that's done to slaves, for instance, and it's a lot of it is based on real stuff, I'm quite sure. And none of it's stuff that people aren't going to have been aware of, or certainly I'd hope they wouldn't. But it's not there to say, like, you know, this is what slaves' lives are like. It's more to give you a reason to, well, to give motivation to the two heroes and for you to have even more reason to hate the two antagonists. It's not there as a exposé of the slave trade or anything like that.
It's not a historical document.
Absolutely not, no.
If you were looking for something like that, you may have been tended to go and see Lincoln and got the wrong cinema on the way in.
It's walked into the wrong screen, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a hoot is what it is. It's not to be taken seriously, but it's a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it immensely. It's certainly well worth seeing if you've got even the hint of it. It is still an exploitation film, as is most of Tarantino's best work, and it's still in that mould. It's just got a bit more budget and a bit more care with the visuals behind it does look far more impressive than most of Tarantino's previous works.
What of the runtime? Because it seems to me that, I know a lot of people who I know have seen it, who have really enjoyed it, have commented as well that it's again, likely Miz, it's at least half an hour too long for its own good.
It could possibly be argued that it is too long, but I genuinely didn't really feel that, whereas I watched that in the same day as watching another film we'll talk about later, and whereas that felt at least twice its length, Django Unchained felt like a much shorter film.
Yeah, the logical part of my brain tells me that this film is too long and could use to cut down a bit, but when I was sitting in front of it, I thought it was very entertaining all the way throughout, and so I have no compunction about recommending people go and see what is another in a run of very long films that are in the cinemas at the moment.
And also, just one little point, it's notable too for me, possibly the only time where Quentin Tarantino's presence in his own film isn't entirely objectionable.
That's true.
Fair enough.
He's found his niche.
Well, with any luck, he gets shot.
Yeah.
Well, ish.
Ish.
Let's not spoil it.
Yeah. No.
I don't want to go into details.
I wasn't that bothered about Django Unchained. I had no intention really of catching up with it at any point, because as much as I enjoyed old school Tarantino back in the day, like I find his current mode quite tiresome, but if he subjects himself to any sort of punishment on screen, then I might actually be tempted to catch up with this on demand when it becomes available.
It is certainly worth that.
Excellente. So, Scott, I do believe there is something you want to tell us about a little film called Zero Dark Thirty.
Zero Dark Thirty from Catherine Bam Bam Bigelow, which is a shout out to anyone who remembers wrestling from the 1990s. Catherine Bigelow, best known recently, of course, for The Hurt Locker, which was a tremendous slice of bomb-diffusing fun. Well, fun's maybe not the accurate term. And it, I suppose, fits thematically that you'd go on and do Zero Dark Thirty, which is a story at its heart about a CIA newbie, Maya, played by Jessica Chastain, assigned to the task of hunting down Osama bin Laden, who you may remember from such hits as 9/11 and generally being a bit of a dick. More or less out of the gates, you're subjected to the wonders of the CIA's enhanced interrogation playbook, as you see the first victim waterboarded to try and get some information out of people. And that's maybe the first point of contention that people have had with this film. There's a lot of talk about how this glorifies the culture of, you know, 24-esque enhanced interrogation technique. You know, we are doing terrible things in order to track down some of these bad characters. The ends are justifying the means and such like that. And it's not fair in the slightest to do this, because what they seem to be mistaking is the fact that this is presented in a somewhat cold, almost documentarian fashion. It's
very dispassionate.
Yeah, it is not going out of its way to show you, you know, a wailing soundtrack or anything like that, or, you know, overlays of people going, how, you know, how immoral this is. This is just something that happened, and it is the facts of the matter that this did happen. Now, is it the responsibility of a filmmaker to automatically tell you that this is a bad thing, or is it perfectly reasonable to let you leave that up to your own morality? I think that it is.
It'd be nice if more people did that, actually, yeah, rather than telling you what you should be thinking.
Exactly. That is basically your first introduction to the world of Zero Dark Thirty, and it's not a nice place, and none of it is. There's not a whole lot to give you in terms of a way of narrative about this film, because it is, as it says, more or less on a tin. It's just the process behind hunting down Osama bin Laden. As it happens, the whole torture thing didn't really work out too well, because it's shown you in the film that it basically just strikes out. They don't really get any particular leads. They come, they grind to a dead end. And it's only when they fall back on such boring old-fashioned methods of bribing people and detective work and, you know, wiretapping and police work, you know, police operations, like the thing should have been in the first place rather than trying to start a war, then they get results, and then they actually go through. And this all leads up to the raid on the compound in Pakistan, where they believe that Osama bin Laden is holed up, and they don't actually have anything confirmed, but there's enough evidence there to invade Pakistani airspace in prototype stealth helicopters with a couple of squads full of Marines who then go in and do the dirty. And again, who needs any of this kind of trial arrest nonsense?
Who needs due process?
Screw you, due process.
Yeah, habeas corpus, habeas corpse. Yeah, that's what we're talking about.
Habeas my corpus, bitch.
Blow!
This is a story that's worth telling, and I'm quite glad that they did not try and sensationalise this in any way. It's all done very matter-of-factly. You can then make your own mind up about what's been going on, the morality of things like that. I didn't want this to be sexed up. What I wasn't expecting, though, was for it to be quite so dull. Jessica Chastain does a tremendous job in this film. She's completely committed to the character, and it does her great credit. Unfortunately, the character isn't particularly interesting, and we don't get any kind of insight into the character. And again, I don't necessarily need to see that, but it would have been nice to get something like that, just to try and give the film a little bit of flavour to it. At the minute, it's very dry, it's entirely, almost entirely matter of fact, and it's very difficult to sustain interest over a film that is nearly three hours, and it does feel a hell of a lot longer.
From what I understand, it's very difficult to get a real handle on her character.
Oh, the problem with her character is she doesn't have one. Mm. She's completely blank. She seems there's really nothing to latch onto there at all.
Yeah, she's entirely dedicated to her job, which is fine. And there's any number of people I've met who are very dedicated to her job, and she's got a very important job, and that's good. But it just doesn't make for great watching. Mm. And at the end of the day, that's kind of the problem with the film, is that the story is fine and it's worth knowing, but it's probably something that you already know. And seeing it regurgitated again in this format is not really the best use case for it, I think. Real spy work tends, apparently, at least on the basis of this, which is at least somewhat reality-based, it's actually a bit dull. There's nothing particularly exciting going on for a lot of it. Even the compound at the end, where you think perhaps seeing an almost documentarian-style military raid would be interesting, but it isn't. It's just very dull. Maybe I'm spoiled by playing too much Rainbow Six and Call of Duty, I don't know. But it just seems to take an awful long time to do anything, and for a lot of it, nothing much happens. There's no tension, there's no drama. All of that's fine in a sort of, if it were a documentary, but it's not a documentary. It is at least trying to be a work of narrative filmmaking, and on that, it fails. So I was less impressed with this than I should be. It's well made, it's well acted, and all the mechanical aspects of it are well above average. I can understand, at least on that basis, why people would have some time for this, but there's just nothing there to latch on to. It needs some kind of hook, and it just doesn't have it. It needs a little bit of butter on this dry toast, and it doesn't have any. There's no butter to be had in this film at all. Not even a little bit of margarine, no flora, nothing.
I can't believe it's not exciting. Drew, are you broadly in concurrence with this?
Pretty much completely, yeah. But again, Jessica Chastain does do very well in that by like the 18th hour of the film, you still find your character watchable, but she's doing a tremendous job with absolutely nothing to work with. Because, I mean, she's just a person who goes to an office and looks at some maps of some stuff and says, the guy's here, and then there's only very few sections in the film where she shows any real emotion. And the character's just, she doesn't, as I said already, she really doesn't have a character. And it's just, it's so very dry. I mean, there have been some things before that have shown, like, you know, films with tradecraft of spy work that can actually make that quite interesting, or obviously a completely different type of film, but something like The Day of the Jackal, which relies simply on a police officer doing his best in investigating stuff, and it was in no way dry at all. So there's precedent for doing stuff in a sort of procedural way without making it tremendously boring.
I'm perhaps more intrigued now to see Zero Dark Thirty because of the hype being layered on it, and that you both concur that it's not all that and a bag of potato chips.
The end bit in particular, which is, it does seem almost real-time, well, not dramatised, a real-time reconstruction of the raid on the compound. Mm. Sort of thing you might expect to see in Crime Watch, actually, but better quality. But there is no tension there at all, as Scott said. And even if they'd done something like, if you saw the people in the office completely remote from it, just hearing what was happening, not being able to see, that may have actually been quite an interesting way to end it. But instead, you see every single second of everything that happens. It goes to like, oh, well, this door's blocked. We better walk around to this door then.
No, don't blow it. I'll open it for you. Okay, over here. Yes.
If I'd suddenly jump cut to a shot of Hillary Clinton just going, and putting her hand over her mouth, and then back to Piano Cat playing Osama Bin Laden out.
That would have been awesome.
It's very, very...
You got pwned, bitch. I'm going second level prestige now.
Yeah, just if they'd blown open a door and Rick Astley's there singing.
Zero Dark Rickroll.
Yep. Yeah, it's...
The part of the film which intrigues me, I have to say, is the raid on the compound, because originally that wasn't part of the film. It was supposed to be a film about the failed attempt to find Osama bin Laden, but then obviously, you know, while the film was in production, they actually did find him and they shot him in the face. The reason I'm interested to see that play out is because I recently read Mark Owen's account.
Doesn't even take that.
No easy day. Yes, he was. He's also apparently one of the SEALs who was there mission to kill bin Laden.
It's a hell of a cover.
Yes, exactly. He's not even from Manchester, can you believe it? And I have to say that it's like quite a mundane book. A lot of it's to do with the sort of day-to-day routine of the SEALs. And then the last sort of third of the book, I guess, details the preparation immediately before the raid, the insertion, and then the actual raid itself. And it wasn't quite what I expected. You know, we've all been raised on a diet of Hollywood macho empowerment fantasies and the notion that elite members of tactical military units behave in a certain way. And there's a certain, I don't know, it's almost stylistic choice to the way these things are carried out. And to read Mark Owen's book, it's actually almost comical in certain respects, both how mundane the operation into the compound is, how little resistance they meet, and crucially, there's a bizarre sort of Looney Tunes aspect to his account in the book of bin Laden and his son actually meeting their end, the sort of complete anticlimax of how they meet their end, that I'm interested to see if it's related the same way in the movie. And obviously I'm not going to discuss that with you guys in the podcast. Maybe there are people out there who don't know that bin Laden got shot in the face and they're going to be massively surprised.
If you don't want to know the results, look away now.
Oh, that had him on my pool scooping to live. But no, I'm still intrigued to see it, but possibly even more so now that I had been looking forward to it, and you've basically sapped all expectation from me, so thanks.
If you're expecting that going into it, something about then, you're probably better placed than I was. Now, I can see why this does get talked about in Oscars. I can see why this is admirable. I can see why it is a challenging film, and I can see why people may like it on those bases. But the problem is it's doing all that at the expense of being any entertainment value at all. And if you're happy enough divorcing that completely from it and just it being a pseudo-documentary of these events, then, you know, that, okay, but that's not what I'd signed up for. And like I'm saying, even though I don't want it to be particularly sensationalised and gory, it should at least make some efforts at being a film if you're going to portray it as that. Otherwise, just do a documentary.
It needs some sort of tension or something, some narrative drive to it that it just is sorely lacking.
What surprised me about people's response to this film, again, having not seen it, but having read sort of various people's responses to it, obviously there was this silly backlash against the film, which Catherine Bigelow has felt the need to speak out against, that people have levelled bizarre accusations at it, that it glorifies torture, whereas I understand it portrays, quotation marks, enhanced interrogation. The notion that it portrays that on film it's not condoning it.
No, it's saying, here is torture, here is what they did. Not this is good or bad. This is what they did.
And it didn't work.
Yeah, what surprises me about it, though, is that in choosing not to condone torture and being agnostic, as it were, about the efforts of the American intelligence community, that I haven't actually heard much response from sort of flag-waving Americans decrying it for not being patriotic. But I don't know, I haven't seen the film, so perhaps the fact that Osama bin Laden gets shot in the face, spoiler alert, is patriotic enough. But from what I understand, I'm confused by this. On one hand, Catherine Bigelow staunchly refusing to make any moral judgment on any of the actions of the American intelligence community for such a mainstream film. If there were to be any controversy over it, I would have expected it to be that, you know, American audiences would have found it unpatriotic. But maybe I've just got the placid, understanding American man on the street wrong.
Perhaps. Possibly also, if you're not paying attention, you might come out of it thinking, yeah, that torture worked. Because it's not written in vast, you know, fireworks in the sky telling you that what happened to the torture is that it wound up with a lot of dead ends and didn't really work in the end of the day. There's a couple of lines of dialogue saying, oh, look, we found this lead from, you know, 5 years ago that we put in a filing cabinet and forgot about. And then they pursue that and go, and it turns out that it's, you know, freely volunteered information that winds up putting them on the right track.
That didn't involve convincing someone that they were drowning.
No.
Oh, well.
You may well think, if you're not paying a lot of attention, that's probably unfair, but if you think you weren't paying a lot of attention, then you might think that they were actually making progress when they were waterboarding people, when in fact they weren't, and they were running around in circles. But other than the rest of that is, it certainly couldn't be called unpatriotic, because it's not really showing anyone in a bad light. It's not making people out to be villains, is what I'm trying to say. It's not showing you, you know, horrible torture and doing it. It's presented in a matter-of-fact way. This is what happened. Mm. Make your own mind up.
Exactly. Here are some people. They worked quite hard. You know, there's no, like, gung-ho hero or anything, but yeah, as Scott said, there's no villain.
Yeah, they're not people running around torturing people and going, I enjoy torturing you, Towelhead. Well, I don't know why they have that accent. But, you know,
I am your father.
They're just shown as best they can professionals doing a job that they don't particularly like doing, but they think they need to do it at the time to try and catch this guy. It's not being unpatriotic. I don't think it's defending them in any way. It's just saying, here's what happened. Now go and make your own mind up about it.
Very interesting. I shall probably still catch up with this on demand in that case then. That's becoming my sort of stock, my stock response to... Yes, listeners, after, what's this now, 102 episodes? Mm-hmm. Let me be the first to... 103. I am lazy. I find it difficult to get off my ass and go to the cinema. Okay, so that leaves us with Gangster Squad, which I believe Drew is going to give us some kind of startling insight into.
That would be difficult.
That would be quite a trick. Yeah. So I'll not try and pull that off because I'll fall flat on my arse.
You have no ambition, sir.
Much like the film.
Much like the film, yes. In Brian De Palma's 1987 classic, The Untouchables, a law enforcement official handpicks from the seething masses of bent cops a group of incorruptible colleagues to aid him in his crusade against a mafia boss who is ruining his beloved city.
Boo.
And attempts to bring his reign of terror to an end.
Yes.
Now Gangster Squad is... more or less that same film, but written by and for a 13-year-old.
Yay!
In post-World War II Los Angeles, former boxer Mickey Cohen has worked his way up the ranks of the mafia by being more ruthless than everybody else.
True story.
True story, in that there probably was a person called Mickey Cohen, and there's definitely a city called Los Angeles.
Mickey was a bad man.
Yes. And by being more ruthless than everybody else, I mean raging psychopath, just in case you're in any doubt there. He has the police department in his pocket and controls most of the city, including the judiciary. But it's not enough for him. He wants to control the whole West Coast. I mean, and asked by somebody else in the mafia what he wants now he has LA, he simply replies, more.
More. Why are people so down on ambition? The man's got focus and drive. Get in, Nicky!
He's getting a great evaluation from his line manager.
I did Mickey's performance development review last February. I praised him for his efforts.
Of course, he said he would tear my head off with his bare hands if I didn't, but...
Oh, someone called the HR hotline. Mickey! He's undone all that good progress we made. Okay.
Another compulsory 3-day training course from Croydon for him.
Oh, Mickey.
To try and stop his power growing even further, the chief of the LAPD approaches Sergeant John O'Mara, a former soldier and one of the very few police officers who will stand up to Cohen. And he approaches him to create an off-the-books group of like-minded cops who will attack Cohen and his empire, this group coming to be known as the Gangster Squad.
Take that, Mickey.
Yeah, bit of drama for you. They just make that noise. It's really annoying.
They just hold both hands out.
They're pointing their badminton racket at them.
it's really, really irritating. So they stops.
Take it, Mickey.
But you know, rather than work within the system or use lateral thinking to bring the quarry to justice,
stick it to the man.
A la Elliot Ness's investigation of Al Capone for income tax evasion, the Gangster Squad decide the most expedient way to achieve their aim is to kill everybody.
Yes.
So, cue lots of shooting, ridiculous amounts of blood, and a complete disregard for the law and due procedure. Now, there are some things to recommend in Gangster Squad, certainly. While everything else about it screams B-movie, it has an A-list cast who are entertaining to watch, even if their talents are almost completely squandered in a film where character development is an alien concept. And the late 1940s LA setting is visually appealing, but that's it. It's neither far enough away from, nor close enough to, a good film to be considered a disappointment. Rather, it occupies a middle ground that doesn't really generate enough emotion to raise such thoughts. It's not awful, I certainly wasn't bored by it, but it is entirely forgettable. And as Scott there said in his written review of this, if you want a silly, gory, violent movie, then there is absolutely no reason in the world you would watch this when Django Unchained is around, which, as you said, scratches the same itches and is a much, much better film.
Yeah.
It is a very stupid film. that is damning out with, well, accuracy.
Accuracy, yes.
To be fair, it is one of these films that is stupid enough to be entertaining in a really brainless, daft, idiotic way.
It's fun, it's just not... You can't call it good.
Yeah, but
yes, it's not bad enough to call bad.
I mean, I can't possibly defend this as being anything approaching a good film. I mean, if you compare this to Zero Dark Thirty, obviously Zero Dark Thirty is far, 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 far better made. Unfortunately, that's no fun at all, and this at least is some fun. So it depends on what you're looking for at that particular time when you go into the cinema and you're making your choices. It is amazingly stupid with a cast that I assume were very, very well paid. I can't see any other reason why it would have attracted this kind of cast.
I can't not go and see this. Can't remember what my wife and I went to see at the cinema when the trailer for this came on. But look, let's be honest, Emma Stone is hot.
Absolutely, I can agree more.
Ryan Gosling is hot. I was dry humping my cinema seat at the trailer.
When the tow bed, it was moida.
So it just looks like silly fun, basically. And as we all know, it is based on a true story, so therefore it has historical merit. All right,
I think say the review, it's a true story written with crayons.
Yeah, lots of red crayons.
I cannot really defend this film, but I did think it was a lot of fun, and it's good seeing Sean Penn just chewing up all the scenery in the whole film.
And listen,
teeth marks everywhere.
Sometimes that's all you need.
It's daft, it's fun. I'd still say that if you're in the mood for that kind of thing, as Drew says, Django Unchained's better. Mm. But it's still definitely worth a look when it shows up on the whole formats. It's undemanding fun.
I mean, if you're one afternoon you find that you're feeling about 13 years old mentally, it's spot on.
Yeah.
Well, any afternoon then. 13 year olds mentally, what about, is it suitable for 8 year olds?
Well, I was surprised to find that it was suitable for 15-year-olds, that being its certificate in the UK, but it's even far more violent than that.
Aye.
But I've lost track of what the BBFC is doing these days. They're just picking numbers at random and assigning them an age value to films where...
I think they've basically got a big dartboard.
Baffling. Baffling.
It's bizarre that in terms of violence of the, I think, exponentially the sort of quotient that a filmmaker can get away with in a 15 certificate these days is...
basically all of it. This film has all of the violence.
Bizarre.
And it's still 13, a 15.
But then,
so, I was puzzled by that back in, 1996 when Braveheart came out. It was a 15 and had people's limbs getting chopped off left, right and centre.
But remember, like Schindler's List, they were making concessions to the historical worthiness of that film. What I was trying to say was that they seem to let people get away with any amount of violence they sort of consider, well, whoever they consider necessary in a film these days, but we're still hung up on use of the C word. Using that a couple of times will get you an 18 certificate, whereas you can feel free to shotgun people in the face repeatedly and still expect to attain a 15 certificate, so long as you don't, quote, linger, unquote, on the violence for too long.
Yeah, this country's getting as bad as the United States in that way, too, and it's been really bad for a long time for that. It's like, heaven forfend you have some naughty words or some naughty bits. Mm. Sex is natural and lovely and delightful, whereas killing people is horrible and painful and disgusting. You can show the one to children and not the other.
Here's a multiple choice question. You can tick two of these answers, right? Which of these have you indulged in at any point in your life? Fornication, swearing, brutal murder. Right?
I don't mean that. It wasn't recorded.
Which one of those earns you the lowest certificate in a movie? Bizarre. Bizarre. There you are. Moral judgments on it's the bizarre pendulous swinging of the BBFC aside. So listen,
talking about Michael Fassbender there.
Liam
Neeson maybe.
Look at something like The Untouchables. Okay, at the end of the day, that was a bit of stupid gangster fun. Really, where does it compare to something like that?
Like that with a lobotomy.
Yes.
Well, I'm definitely going to watch it now. Nazhas, I said Nazhas. And with that, I guess we shall probably bid you adieu for this podcast. Does that sound about right?
Hells yes.
Yes.
Yes, excellente. Okay, so thank you once again, as always, for listening. Remember, if you can, take 5 seconds of your life to rate us on iTunes. It would help immeasurably with our rankings and also the feedback. You can follow us on Twitter at The One Liner. You can find us individually on Twitter. It ought not to be too hard. Also, you can email us at podcast@theoneliner.com with any feedback, thoughts, or abuse you care to direct at any of us individually or as a gestalt entity. Other than that, let me just say, I was Craig, Scott was Scott.
I said good day, sir.
And Drew was a Drew.
Don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened.
I think we can all agree with that. Thank you and good night.
Terrible news. I'm out of beer.